agent understands the purpose behind your actions, the better they'll be able to respond appropriately when the situation changes. Commander's intent originated on the battlefield. If a general tells a field commander precisely how to capture a hill and the situation changes, the field commander is forced to return to the general for new orders, which is slow and inefficient. If the general explains the strategy to the field commander and explains why that particular hill is important and how it will support the overall strategy, the field commander is free to use his knowledge of the goal and fresh intelligence to act in a way that supports the original intent. Commander's intent alleviates communication overhead. By communicating the intent behind a certain plan, a leader can make consistent communication less critical for the success of the entire team. If everyone understands the purpose of the plan, everyone can act in ways that support the intent without requiring constant attention. When you communicate the intent behind your plans, you allow the people you work with to intelligently respond to changes as they happen. Bystander apathy. Growing up, I was very active in the Boy Scouts. The standard scout program covers first aid, CPR, and emergency management, basic training that prepares you to handle the most common emergencies you're likely to face. Outside of specific techniques, I remember two useful principles from this training. Number one, always personally step up and take responsibility unless relieved by a more experienced professional. And, number two, always direct commands or requests very clearly to one specific individual at a time. If someone appears to be experiencing a heart attack in a crowded store and you yell, "Someone call 911," it's likely that no one will actually call. The more people around, the more likely everyone will assume that someone else is taking action. It's far more effective to single someone out, make eye contact, point, and say very clearly, "You, call 911. They will. Bystander apathy is an inverse relationship between the number of people who could take an action and the number of people who actually choose to act. The more people available, the less responsibility each member of the crowd feels to do anything about the situation. The 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese and the 2009 shooting of Petru Ballardino are dramatic, well-known examples of bystander apathy. In both cases, the victims were attacked in the presence of many bystanders, none of whom offered assistance. There's some controversy over exactly how many people witnessed the Genovese murder, but there's no doubt about the Ballardino case. It was captured on video. As Ballardino bled to death from a gunshot wound on the floor of a metro station, scores of people who could clearly see what was going on simply walked by. Bystander apathy explains why anything assigned to a committee never gets done. If you've ever worked with a group of people who have no power over one another, you know what I'm talking about. Unless someone steps up and takes individual responsibility for actually making things happen and holding individuals accountable for progress, a committee can deliberate for years without getting anything done. Each member of the committee simply assumes someone else is working on it. The best way to eliminate bystander apathy in project management is to ensure that all tasks have single, clear owners and deadlines. Unless every individual on your team knows exactly what they're responsible for and when it must be done, it's very unlikely that they'll actually do it. When delegating responsibilities, always assign tasks to a single owner with a clear deadline. Only then will people feel responsible for getting things done. The planning fallacy. People are consistently and uniformly horrendous at planning. As uncomfortable as this sounds, any plan created by even the most intelligent and skilled CEO or project manager is very likely to be grossly inaccurate. As Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen memorably quip in their book Rework, planning is guessing. The reason we're so bad at planning is because we're not omniscient. Unforeseen events or circumstances can dramatically impact even the most detailed plans. When we create plans, we're simply guessing and using interpretation to fill in the blanks, no matter how much we cloak that uncomfortable reality in official-sounding language and fancy-looking charts. The planning fallacy means that people have a persistent tendency to underestimate completion times. The more complex the project, the more interdependencies the project contains. The more interdependencies there are, the more likely it is that something at some time will not go according to plan. When planning, we naturally tend to imagine a scenario in which everything goes well. As a result, we tend to underestimate the likelihood of things that could impact the plan, as well as how much those contingencies will affect the project. Rare is the project plan that contains a line item that says, "Project manager contracts mononucleosis, out for a month." Most plans drastically underestimate the amount of slack necessary to make the plan accurate. If you're responsible for completing a complex project, including a few months of slack time is appropriate. Unexpected delays, vacations, sicknesses, and other unforeseen events are likely to make things take longer than expected. The challenge is that including significant slack time is almost never seen as acceptable or appropriate. If you go to a CEO, customer, or partner with a plan that involves 3 months of slack time, the most common response is, "That's not acceptable. Get it done faster." The slack is eliminated, and as a result, almost every project plan is very likely to be completely wrong. The inaccuracy of plans doesn't make planning worthless. Plans aren't useful because they help you predict with better accuracy. They're useful because the act of creating the plan helps you understand requirements, dependencies, and risks more thoroughly than when you started. In the words of Dwight D. Eisenhower, "No battle was ever won according to plan, but no battle was ever won without one." Plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. The value of planning is in the mental simulation, the thought process required to create the plan itself. Use plans, but don't depend on them. As long as you keep working as quickly and effectively as possible, the project will be done as soon as it's feasible. Referrals. When your car breaks down, whom would you rather take it to? A mechanic who's a friend of a friend, or a random operation you found in the phone directory? Given the choice, people always prefer to interact with people they know and like. Referrals make it far easier for people to decide to work with someone they don't know. Referrals are effective because they transfer the qualities of being known and liked. The reason you're more likely to go to a mechanic your friend recommends is that you know and like your friend, and your friend knows and likes that mechanic. Even if the competing mechanic in the phone book is highly qualified, that doesn't matter as much as being known and liked. The referral transfers the knowing and liking effect to the recipient. Instead of being a risky unknown quantity, they're suddenly a friend. Cold calling doesn't work very well because the caller is unknown. Remember, our minds tend to treat unknown people and situations as potential threats, which activates our natural defenses. If someone doesn't already know or like you, you're going to have a tough time convincing them to do what you want. Even the most obscure commonalities can significantly warm up a cold connection. If someone mentions they're from the same area as you, or that they went to the same college, or know the same person, you'll automatically start to like them more, even though the connection may be very tenuous. The last year Kelsey sold wedding gowns in Manhattan, over 70% of her sales came from referrals. When you're considering spending $10,000 or more on a designer dress, you want to work with someone you know and like. And Kelsey's previous customers really liked working with her. Before they entered the salon, most of Kelsey's prospective customers already knew and liked her, and she closed many more sales as a result. The more people who know, like, and trust you, the better off you are. Referrals are the best way to expand your network of personal connections. Planning. In 1954, 22 12-year-old boys were selected to attend a special summer camp in Robbers Cave State Park in Oklahoma. Here's what made the summer camp special. The camp was actually a psychology experiment, operated under the direction of Drs. Musaffer and Sherilyn Sharif. Each of the boys was intentionally selected to be as similar to the rest of the group as possible. The psychologists ensured that all of the boys had similar IQs, families, and childhood experiences. Before the experiment started, the group of 22 was split into two groups and placed on opposite sides of the park. By design, neither group knew the other existed. The original plan was to let each group coalesce for a while, then make them aware that the other group existed to see what would happen. The camp counselors were psychologists and graduate students who would be watching the events unfold up close and personal. Here's what happened. The groups accidentally discovered each other earlier than planned, and hostilities started immediately. As soon as the boys discovered there was another group in their camp, they rallied together in preparation and defense. Humans naturally tend to form distinct groups, a process called clanning. One group of boys began calling themselves the Eagles, while the other group self-identified as the Rattlers. Distinct group identities formed to help members identify insiders and outsiders. The Eagles created an image of themselves as the heroic good guys, while the Rattlers took on the persona of misfits and rebels. With surprising speed, minor provocations like put-downs and stealing the other group's flag turned into chaos, campsite raids and dining hall fistfights. Competitive activities like sports were a disaster. For the safety of the campers, the researchers quickly tried to find a way to resolve the conflict. The psychologists introduced challenges and goals that required both groups to work together, solving a water shortage, deciding on a movie to watch, and pushing a broken-down truck back to camp. When the campers started feeling like part of a larger group, the conflicts subsided. Clanning is a natural human tendency. We're automatically and profoundly influenced by the people around us. Identifying ourselves as part of a group and distinguishing ourselves from other groups is an instinct that explains many of the ongoing wars and conflicts featured in the news every day. Think of sports fans. The players, coaches, and even stadiums and uniforms change so often it's difficult to understand what exactly the fans are cheering for. The life of a rabid New York Yankees fan will go on unchanged regardless of whether their team wins or loses. While that may be true, it doesn't feel that way to the fan. When the Yanks win, the fans feel like winners too. Sports rivalries happen for the same reason. I grew up in Northern Ohio, where the Ohio State-Michigan State rivalry is alive and well. Where I come from, during certain parts of the year, Michigan is evil in the eyes of Ohio State fans. If you look at the situation from a distance, it's absolutely silly. College kids scrambling for a little brown ball, while hundreds of thousands of people scream themselves hoarse. In the moment, however, for those two groups, the enmity is everything. Groups naturally form around important issues, positions, or events. Understand the group dynamic, or you're likely to be caught up in it. Convergence and divergence. Over time, you become more and more like those whom you spend time with, and less like people in other groups. Convergence is the tendency of group members to become more alike over time. In business, this is sometimes called a company's culture, in the sense that people who work there tend to have similar characteristics, behaviors, and philosophies. Convergence also means that groups have a tendency to police themselves. The norms of the group work like gravity. If they are violated, others will exert an influence on the rebel to bring them back in line. As the proverb goes, the tallest blade of grass is the first to be cut. If you've ever worked for a company with a workaholic culture, you know how powerful convergence can be. If it's normal for workers to come in at 6 o'clock in the morning and stay until 10:30 at night, it can be difficult to keep shorter working hours, since violating the norms is a social signal that you don't belong in the group. One of my clients, who works for a major medical research institution, often has conflicts with coworkers who believe he's not pulling his weight because he leaves work at 5 p.m. instead of 7:30 p.m., even though he does great work and gets everything done. Instead of being viewed as working smart, going home at a reasonable hour is seen as a form of treason. It's sad, but common. Divergence is the tendency for groups to become less like other groups over time. Since group behavior often evolves to clearly distinguish members of one group from another, the norms of most groups constantly change to resist being confused with another group or imitator. Divergence explains why fashions among the socialite class in New York City change so quickly and dramatically. In certain social circles, dress is a way to signal your wealth or status. When the latest fashions start appearing in Target so people can imitate the look, fashions change to compensate. This constant divergence keeps the group affiliation signal valid. The groups you spend time with automatically and profoundly influence your behavior. According to the late Jim Rohn, author of The Art of Exceptional Living, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. The values and behaviors of the people you interact with on a daily basis exert constant pressures on you to adopt the same values and behaviors. Convergence can be useful if you consciously choose to spend time with people you'd like to become more like over time. If you'd like to become less shy and more outgoing, spending time with social people in social situations can't help but influence your behavior. You won't become a social butterfly overnight, but you will naturally start to adopt the behaviors and norms of the people you're spending time with. This approach works for anything. If you want to test a raw food diet for a while, spend more time hanging out with people who eat that way. Used consciously, you can use convergence to make habit change easier. Breaking away from groups that aren't serving you is painful but necessary to grow. People who want to quit smoking or drinking often find it extremely difficult to quit because a large portion of their social network engages in those behaviors. Taking a smoke break at 3 p.m. or attending a 6 p.m. happy hour is a very significant social event. If your friends are expecting you, the temptation is even harder to resist. To make significant changes, it's often necessary to leave one group and find another that's more supportive of where you want to go, which is why joining support groups like Alcoholics Anonymous is a very effective way to change specific behaviors. Once you realize how powerful convergence and divergence are, you can use them to your advantage. If your social circle isn't supporting your goals, change your social circle. Social signals. A Rolex doesn't tell time any better than a Timex. That's not the point. People will expend huge sums of money and energy to send social signals. A Gucci handbag doesn't carry items any better than a JanSport backpack, and a Porsche 911 won't, legally, get you from point A to point B any faster than a Honda Civic. Luxury items can cost many times more than their more functional counterparts, but function is not the purpose. The benefit lies in sending a message to other people. Social signals are tangible indicators of some intangible quality that increases a person's social status or group affiliation. People don't wear sports jerseys because they're stylish. They're ugly by any aesthetic measure. People wear them because they want to clearly affiliate themselves with their favorite team. It's a statement of identity. Signals sometimes have little or nothing to do with the reality of what the signal is supposed to communicate. In the book The Millionaire Next Door, Thomas Stanley and William Danko describe the lives and habits of people who have a net worth of over $1 million. More often than not, they live in modest houses, drive used cars, and buy inexpensive clothing. If you think about it, that makes sense. The best way to build wealth is to earn a lot of money without spending it. People who want to signal they're well off, on the other hand, tend to spend their money on items that communicate wealth and status: large houses, luxury cars, designer clothing, and expensive vacations. These purchases are often financed with debt. If you look at the bank statements of the seemingly well-to-do, you'll often find that they're in a precarious financial position. Social signals have real economic value, so it pays to build them into your offer if you can. Part of building a signaling value into something is understanding what people want to signal to others. Since signals go back to the core human drives, acquisition, bonding, learning, defending, and feeling, people want to signal that they're wealthy, attractive, intelligent, high status, interesting, and confident. Connecting your offer to one of these qualities via association is a surefire way to make people desire your offer more strongly. Use social signals to your advantage, and you'll make people want what you have to offer. Social proof. Have you ever stood waiting for a stoplight to change while crossing the street when the person standing next to you suddenly started walking? Chances are, you unconsciously started moving too, unless you used willpower to consciously inhibit the response. In most situations, the actions of other individuals in our situation are a very strong indication that it's okay to behave in a certain way. When the situation is ambiguous, we learn by watching the behavior of others. If you don't know how to act in Rome, doing what the Romans do is a pretty safe bet. Social proof can take on a life of its own. Fads often form when one person takes an action. Others perceive it as a social signal, then act the same way, creating a social feedback loop. Pet rocks, yellow Lance Armstrong Livestrong bracelets, viral videos, and stock market bubbles all gain power via social proof. If so many other people are doing it, it's easy to come to the conclusion that you should probably do it too. Testimonials are an effective form of social proof often used in business to close more sales. There's a reason why Amazon.com and other online retailers prominently feature user reviews. Stories about people who have been pleased with a purchase send a clear signal that an item is safe to buy, so more people purchase. The best testimonials don't necessarily contain superlatives. Amazing, best, life-changing, and revolutionary have been so overused that people expect them and discount their expectations accordingly. The most effective testimonials tend to follow this format. I was interested in this offer, but skeptical. I decided to purchase anyway, and I'm very pleased with the end result. The reason this format is more effective than a litany of people gushing about your offer is that it more closely matches how your prospects are feeling, interested, but uncertain. By signaling that the decision was a good one, testimonials tell your prospects that it's safe to buy. Add a bit of social proof to your offers, and your sales will soar. Authority. In the 1970s, Sanka, a mass-market coffee brand, hired Robert Young, an actor, to promote the health benefits of decaffeinated coffee. Young was better known to the public as Dr. Marcus Welby, the lead character of the popular television show Marcus Welby, M.D. Even though Young wasn't an expert on the medical effects of caffeine, people still perceived him as an authority, and bought Sanka. The approach worked so well that Sanka used Dr. Welby to promote their product for decades. People have an inherent tendency to comply with authority figures. This tendency begins in childhood. We wouldn't survive very long if we didn't obey our parents most of the time. As we grow up, we're socialized to respect and obey other authority figures: teachers, police officers, government officials, and clergy. As a result, when an authority figure asks us to do something, we're very likely to comply, even if the request isn't appropriate or doesn't make sense. People tend to comply with authority figures even if they'd refuse to take the same action under normal circumstances. In a famously disturbing social psychology experiment, Stanley Milgram proved that most individuals will comply with authority figures to a surprising degree, even if the request appears to be morally wrong. In a series of experiments that began in 1961, Milgram placed test subjects in a room with a quote-unquote scientist in a white lab coat and another individual, both whom were actors. The subject was told the study was about the effect of punishment on learning, and one of the participants was randomly selected to be the learner, the actor. The learner was taken to an adjacent room, strapped into a chair, and attached to electrodes. The test subject's job as the teacher was to read the learner questions, then shock the learner if they responded incorrectly. The shocks weren't real, but the actor would scream, cry, and beg to be released from the study. Every few minutes, the scientist would instruct the teacher to raise the voltage of the shocks. The intent of the study was to see how long the test subject would obey the scientist before refusing to continue. The results were disturbing. 80% of participants continued past the point where the learner begged to stop, and 65% continued all the way to the maximum level of 450 volts, which was clearly marked as deadly. Throughout the study, the subjects were clearly uncomfortable and uncertain, but the scientist told them to continue, so they obeyed. Authority figures are automatically and strongly persuasive. In the presence of an authority figure, people will do things they'd otherwise view as reprehensible or wouldn't consider in the first place, the source of many a scandal involving famous and powerful people. If you're in a position of authority, your authority will change the way others interact with you. Simply because you express an opinion, your subordinates will be far more likely to interpret your position as a truth or as a command. As a result, people will begin to filter the information they give you based on what they think you want to hear, which may not be what you need to hear. This filtering behavior is how authority figures often end up living in a bubble. The combination of authority and confirmation bias shelters them from information that contradicts their opinions. As a result, it's difficult for authority figures to compensate for the excessive self-regard tendency. Developing a strong reputation in a certain area confers the benefits of authority. Not all parts of authority are insidious. If people respect your knowledge and experience, they're more likely to do what you suggest. As a result, developing clear expertise and a strong reputation can be beneficial. It increases your own influence. Work to establish yourself as an authority on what you're offering, and people will be more likely to accept your offer. Commitment and consistency. A few months ago, Kelsey received a phone call from our alma mater asking for a donation. Here's the twist. They didn't ask for the donation outright. Instead, they asked if she'd be willing to donate money to the university in the future. Thinking nothing of it, she agreed and promptly forgot about the call. Shortly before we moved from New York to Colorado, an official-looking invoice for $150 from the university appeared in the mail. It said, "Here is your $150 commitment. You can send your check via the enclosed envelope." Money was tight, since we were paying for movers, buying cars, and purchasing furniture, but Kelsey sent the check anyway. After all, she had promised, right? No one wants to be considered an oathbreaker. Commitments have been used throughout history as a way of binding groups together. Breaking a promise or commitment can often have a negative impact on social status and reputation, so most people will do whatever they can to act in ways that are consistent with previous positions and promises. Even small commitments make it more likely that individuals will take actions consistent with those commitments in the future. One of my favorite stories about commitment comes from Michael Masterson, the author of the book Ready, Fire, Aim. On a trip to India, Masterson visited a rug merchant. He entered a shop with a healthy level of skepticism and absolutely no intention of buying anything. He was just interested in the experience. The rug merchant was an excellent salesman and relied on two primary strategies. To break down Masterson's skepticism, he used stories, or narratives, of past sales to encourage Masterson to like and trust him before the selling began. Then he used commitment. Whenever Masterson so much as looked at a rug, the proprietor would have his staff take it down off the racks to examine it closely. The rugs were heavy, and it was clear that the sales staff was working hard on his behalf. By making a small commitment, expressing interest in a particular rug, Masterson provoked a flurry of action. As the minutes passed, it became difficult for Masterson to imagine leaving without purchasing a rug. It would be inconsistent with the interest he'd expressed and the work the proprietor's staff were doing for him. The least he could do was reciprocate. How could he tell them no? In the end, he purchased a rug for $8,200 and walked away a happy customer. Obtaining small commitments makes it more likely people will choose to act consistently with them later. Salespeople are often taught to do what they can to encourage their customers to start saying yes as soon as possible. By getting a foot in the door, they increase the probability that the prospect will take further action. That's why so many activists use opening questions like, "Do you care about child safety?" or "Do you care about the environment?" when telemarketing or collecting signatures on a petition. Most people do care about these things, so the reply is automatic and swift. Once you've said you care about something, however, it would be rude of you to refuse their request. It's inconsistent with your previous statement. Obtain a small commitment, and you'll make it far more likely that others will comply with your request. Incentive-caused bias. If you're working with a real estate agent or mortgage broker, they're primarily interested in convincing you to buy a house. Accordingly, most agents won't tell you that it's in your best interest to rent, even if it's true. Incentive-caused bias explains why people with a vested interest in something will tend to guide you in the direction of their interest. We touched on the idea of incentive-caused bias when talking about buffers. If you're working with an agent who's paid on commission, it's not necessarily in their best interest to tell you that purchasing something is not a good idea. As the saying goes, don't ask the barber if you need a haircut. Incentives automatically influence the way people act, based on how they're rewarded. As a result, the structure of the incentives people are exposed to has a significant impact on behavior. Assuming that the things people are controlling for stay the same, changing the incentives is also likely to change behavior. In the book The Knack, Norm Brodsky and Bo Burlingham describe how they compensate their salespeople. Most companies compensate salespeople on a commission basis. Closing more sales nets the salesperson more money. Under this incentive structure, their salespeople were hyper-focused on closing sales, even if those sales weren't profitable or in the long-term interest of the company. By compensating their salespeople on a salary basis and giving generous bonuses based on long-term performance, Brodsky and Burlingham encouraged them to focus on making profitable sales versus sales at any cost. Sometimes incentives create unintended second-order effects, which we'll discuss later. Stock options were created under the theory that executives who had an interest in the company's stock price would act in ways to make the stock go up in value over time, which was in the best interest of the shareholders. That's true, but only to a point. The actual interest of those executives is in making the stock price go up right before they intend to sell. Once the options are sold, executives no longer care so much, leading to policies that sacrifice long-term stability for short-term gains. Incentives are tricky because they inevitably interact with our perceptual control systems. For example, giving an employee a bonus or raise for doing something good can create a curious result. They stop doing what got them the reward. That makes no sense until you realize there was always a reward. They did what they did because they wanted to, so the reward was internal. Paying them makes the action part of their job, which reduces their inner drive to complete it for its own sake. In the case of conflict, perceptual controls win over incentives every time. Incentives can be useful if used appropriately, but tread cautiously. If the incentives of the people you work with aren't aligned with your interests, you're bound to have problems. Modal bias. A few years ago, I was traveling on business with a colleague who was amazed that I was carrying a shoulder bag instead of a rolling suitcase. It was an overnight trip, so I didn't need much: a change of clothes, my computer, and a book. I had everything I needed, and the bag wasn't heavy, so my solution worked just fine. My colleague thought my solution was absurd and spent the next 10 minutes telling me so. It's much better to carry a rolling suitcase. It would be more comfortable and there'd be less weight. You should always carry a rolling suitcase. Modal bias is the automatic assumption that our idea or approach is always best. Most of us like to assume we have everything together, that we know what we're talking about, we know what we're doing, and that our way of doing things is best. Very often, we are quite mistaken. There is always more than one way to get something done, and good ideas can come from anywhere. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, the HIPPO rules. Decisions are made according to the highest paid person's opinion. HIPPO is a term coined by Avinash Kashyap in the book Web Analytics, An Hour a Day, to explain why it's critically important to support business proposals and decisions with data. In the absence of data, you'll ultimately be forced to do things the boss's way. Modal bias ensures that the bosses think that their way is best unless you can prove otherwise. In a battle of opinions, the HIPPO always wins. The best way to avoid modal bias is to use inhibition to temporarily suspend judgment. Part of the value of understanding cognitive biases is the knowledge that you are not immune to them, and simply knowing they exist doesn't make them any less influential. Modal bias is automatic. We have to use willpower to overcome it. If you're a leader or manager, it pays to consciously suspend your judgment long enough to thoroughly consider the perspectives and suggestions of the people you work with. Otherwise, you're very likely to miss important information. Remind yourself to keep an open mind, and you'll enhance your ability to make wise decisions. The Pygmalion effect. Individuals tend to rise to the level of other people's expectations of them. In general, people tend to perform up to the level that others expect them to perform. If you don't expect much from the people you work with, it's likely you won't inspire them to perform to the limits of their capabilities. Let them know you expect great things from them, and more often than not, you'll find that they perform very well. The Pygmalion effect is a tendency named after the protagonist of a Greek myth. Pygmalion was a gifted sculptor who created a statue of a woman so perfect that he fell in love with his creation. After Pygmalion desperately prayed to Aphrodite, the goddess of love, she took pity on him by bringing the statue to life. The Pygmalion effect explains why all of our relationships are, in a very real sense, self-fulfilling prophecies. The effect was first verified in studies that examined the relationship between teachers and students. If a teacher believed a student was gifted or smart, the teacher would act in ways that encouraged the student to live up to that assessment. If the teacher believed a student was difficult or challenged, they wouldn't receive as much support and wouldn't perform as well, a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie recommends giving others a great reputation to live up to. He was a wise man. Raise your expectations of others, and they'll naturally do their best to satisfy those expectations. The Pygmalion effect isn't an excuse to have unrealistic expectations of other people. Even the best builder on earth couldn't replicate the pyramids of Egypt in an afternoon, so expecting that level of performance from anyone is a recipe for disappointment and frustration. Expecting quality and performance is one thing. Expecting miracles is unrealistic. The Pygmalion effect also features a paradox. Having high expectations of people will produce better results, but it also increases the probability that you'll be disappointed. The expectation effect means that our perception of the quality of someone's work is a function of our original expectations. The higher our expectations are to begin with, the higher their performance will generally be, but the risk that our expectations will be violated is also much higher. If you're doing a formal assessment of someone's performance, remember to judge performance objectively and quantitatively as much as possible. Let others know you expect great work from them, and they'll do their best to live up to your expectations. Attribution error. Let's assume you hire a contractor to build a house and give him a clear deadline for completion. The deadline comes and goes, and the project isn't done. 3 months go by before the house is complete. Unless you're feeling particularly charitable, you're likely to think the contractor is unprofessional, lazy, or inexperienced. You tell all of your friends who are interested in building a house not to hire that contractor. He overpromises and underdelivers. Now imagine the situation from the contractor's point of view. The original plan was to buy lumber from a particular supplier that is typically trustworthy, but one of their trucks broke down, delaying the shipment. The situation required finding another supplier on short notice, which was difficult, since supplies of the materials were scarce. The contractor moved heaven and earth to get the job done as quickly as possible. Without the contractor's intervention, the project would have been delayed 6 months instead of 3. The attribution error means that when others screw up, we blame their character. When we screw up, we attribute the situation to circumstances. By assuming the contractor's actions were due to a character flaw, you made an error in judgment. The contractor actually went above and beyond the call of duty, given the circumstances. Because you weren't completely aware of the circumstances, however, you blamed his character. Avoiding the attribution error makes it easier to stay on good terms with people you work with. If you're working with someone who consistently fails to perform to expectations or deliver what they're supposed to, then you have a legitimate issue that needs to be resolved. Otherwise, it's beneficial to give people the benefit of the doubt unless a particular behavior clearly becomes a pattern. When you understand the reason behind a person's actions, it usually makes you see their behavior in a different light. When something isn't going as expected, try to find out as much as you can about the circumstances surrounding the behavior you're noticing. More often than not, you'll find that it's a matter of circumstances, not a fundamental character flaw. Option orientation. When something goes wrong, how you handle the crisis matters. Mistakes and issues happen all the time, so planning your response in advance goes a long way toward minimizing the impact of the unexpected. Fixating on the issue is the least productive thing you can do when something goes wrong. By the time you're aware of an issue, preventing it is beyond your locus of control. The issue has already occurred. The only question is how you plan to respond to it. Imagine that you report to the CEO of a company that makes microwaves, and you've just received a report that a few of your microwaves have exploded, burning several homes to the ground. That's a major issue. How do you think the CEO will respond if your approach is, "Boss, we have an issue. What do we do? Tell us what to do." Unless your CEO is a very patient soul, the response will probably be, "I know we have an issue. Help me figure out our options." Fixate on the hand-wringing, and you'll soon be out of a job. Instead of dwelling on the problem, focus on your options. Ruminating on the issue doesn't solve anything. What are you going to do about it? By focusing your energy on evaluating potential responses, you're far more likely to find a way to make things better. Here's an alternate approach your hypothetical CEO is probably going to find more useful. We've received several reports of fires caused by our microwaves. Here are our options. We can have our engineers run a full diagnostic before we issue a statement and risk further issues, or we can issue an immediate recall. Based on the information we have available right now, it appears our microwaves are at fault and present a major risk to the safety of our customers. Based on our options, I recommend an immediate recall, which we estimate will cost $4 million. Focusing on the potential options is far more constructive. You're presenting several courses of action and the costs and benefits associated with each, then recommending a solution based on the available information. The CEO, or client, can then review your recommendation and the options you present, ask follow-up questions, and then make the best decision possible. Do this often and well, and you'll develop a reputation for clear-headedness in the midst of crisis. Focus on options, not issues, and you'll be able to handle any situation life throws at you. Management. Much has been made in business schools of quote-unquote scientific management and the need for highly educated, professionally trained managers. In reality, you can't learn to be a competent manager in a classroom. Beyond a few simple principles, it's a skill best learned through experience. Management is simple, but not simplistic. In essence, management is the act of coordinating a group of people to achieve a specific goal while accounting for ever-present change and uncertainty. It's like taking the helm of a ship during a storm. All you can do is move the wheel back and forth, which is simple, but it takes experience and skill to do it well. Based on what we've learned thus far, here are six simple principles of effective real-world management. Number one, recruit the smallest group of people who can accomplish what must be done quickly and with high quality. Comparative advantage means that some people will be better than others at accomplishing certain tasks, so it pays to invest time and resources in recruiting the best team for the job. Don't make that team too large, however. Communication overhead makes each additional team member beyond a core group of 3 to 8 people a drag on performance. Small, elite teams are best. Number two, clearly communicate the desired end result, who is responsible for what, and the current status. Everyone on the team must know the commander's intent of the project, the reason why it's important, and must clearly know the specific parts of the project they're individually responsible for completing. Otherwise, you're risking bystander apathy. Number three, treat people with respect. Consistently using the golden trifecta, appreciation, courtesy, and respect, is the best way to make the individuals on your team feel important and is also the best way to ensure that they respect you as a leader and manager. The more your team works together under mutually supportive conditions, the more clanning will naturally occur and the more cohesive the team will become. Number four, create an environment where everyone can be as productive as possible, then let people do their work. The best working environment takes full advantage of guiding structure. Provide the best equipment and tools possible and ensure that the environment reinforces the work the team is doing. To avoid having energy sapped by the cognitive switching penalty, shield your team from as many distractions as possible, which includes non-essential bureaucracy and meetings. Number five, refrain from having unrealistic expectations regarding certainty and prediction. Create an aggressive plan to complete the project, but be aware in advance that uncertainty and the planning fallacy mean that your initial plan will almost certainly be incomplete or inaccurate in a few important respects. Update your plan as you go along, using what you learn along the way, and continually reapply Parkinson's Law to find the shortest feasible path to completion that works, given the necessary trade-offs required by the work. Number 6. Measure to see if what you're doing is working. If not, try another approach. One of the primary fallacies of effective management is that it makes learning unnecessary. This mindset assumes that your initial plan should be 100% perfect and followed to the letter. The exact opposite is true. Effective management means planning for learning, which requires constant adjustments along the way. Constantly measure your performance across a small set of key performance indicators, which we'll discuss in a little bit. If what you're doing doesn't appear to be working, experiment with another approach. Do these well, and your team will be highly productive. Do them poorly, and you'll be fortunate to get anything useful done at all. This style of management is not the command and control style of management most people think of when they hear the term. On TV and in most management literature, managers are high-status executives who spend most of their time telling other people what to do and making important decisions. In practice, those behaviors are telltale signs of poor management. The best managers don't act like big-shot executives. They're more like very skilled assistants, whose primary purpose is to keep the people with economically valuable skills focused on improving the five parts of every business. That is, doing things that directly contribute to the company's results. Important decisions are made by the individuals who have the most direct knowledge and experience about the area in question. In a recent essay, software entrepreneur Joel Spolsky explains why managers should stop calling the shots and start letting people do their jobs. Stop thinking of the management team at the top of the organization. Start thinking of the software developers, the designers, the product managers, and the frontline salespeople as the top of the organization. The management team isn't the decision-making team. It's a support function. You may want to call them administration instead of management, which will keep them from getting too big for their britches. Administrators aren't supposed to make the hard decisions. They don't know enough. Administrators exist to move the furniture around so that the people at the top of the tree can make the hard decisions. That's the way it has to work in a knowledge organization. You don't build a startup with one big gigantic brain at the top and a bunch of lesser brains obeying orders down below. You try to get everyone to have a gigantic brain in their area, and you provide a minimum amount of administrative support to keep them humming along. End quote. Management is a unique skill that requires discipline, patience, clear communication, and a commitment to keeping everyone working together without unnecessary distractions. By recruiting a good team and eliminating as much friction as possible, you'll achieve the results you're seeking. Performance-based hiring. What if you need to build a team? What if you're responsible for recruiting new employees as your company grows? How do you attract and retain the best employees you can find? Hiring is a tricky business, and there's no foolproof method to find, attract, and retain star employees and contractors. Mistakes in hiring are almost always expensive, and a bad hire can cost you precious time and money, and your team's limited energy and patience. Good employees and contractors are not necessarily the people who have the fanciest resume or perform the best in a phone screen or interview. The best hires are people who get things done and work well with other members of your team. Ideally, you're looking for an individual who will contribute valuable work, who's excited about the opportunity, and who you'll enjoy working with every day. Here's the golden rule of hiring. The best predictor of future behavior is past performance. If you want to hire people who will perform well for you in the months and years to come, you need to look for people who have performed well in the past. That means digging deep into what the applicant has accomplished, as well as giving each serious candidate a short-term opportunity to work with you before committing to a longer-term engagement. The first step in hiring is to publicize that you're looking for help. Announcing the job typically involves writing a job description, which is either published in a public format or used by a recruiter to search private networks. Either way, don't write the job description like an advertisement. You want to describe what the applicant will actually do on a day-to-day basis if they work for you, with as much unembellished detail as you can share. You're looking for people who are attracted to the work, and it's difficult for applicants to determine whether or not they'll be a good fit unless you describe exactly what the job involves. Next, identify a basic acid test to screen applicants. In weak employment markets, new job postings tend to be overwhelmed with applicants, many of whom are poor candidates. You'll need a way to identify the most promising candidates as quickly as possible. Screening by degree or GPA is common but ineffective, since they don't tell you anything about the candidate's current level of skill. In the application, ask a few basic questions that require a certain amount of specialized knowledge in the field to answer. The most promising candidates will be easy to identify. Once you've identified a few promising candidates, ask each one to show you examples of two or three of their best projects to date. These projects don't have to be directly related to the job in question, but they should be work that the applicant is proud of and that they believe highlights their skills. The idea is to see examples of what the candidate has accomplished to date, which makes it easier to gauge their relative level of experience and work ethic. If a candidate claims that they have 5 years of experience in product development, but can't show you something they've created, that's a red flag. Checking references at this point is a good use of time. Along with the examples, request the names and contact information of people they worked with in the process. When you contact a candidate's references, your question should be simple, like, would they work with the candidate again? If they hesitate or talk around the question, it's a no. If you can't reach a reference when you call, leave a message and ask them to contact you if the candidate is extraordinary. If they are, you'll receive a return call. If they aren't, you won't. Finally, give promising candidates a short turnaround project or scenario to see how they think, work, and communicate firsthand. Small projects tend to work best for skilled technical employees, while scenarios work best for candidates who will be responsible for product creation, marketing, sales, business development, finance, and management roles. The outcome of the assignment should be a deliverable of some kind: a report, a pitch, an asset, or a process. Don't put the candidate in an artificial environment. They should be free to use whatever tools or resources they're comfortable using. They should be free to contact you if they have questions. On completion of the project, bring the candidate in to meet you and present their results. This presentation replaces the interview. The purpose of the project or scenario is to evaluate the candidate's actual work in a realistic environment. What does the candidate focus on first? What do they notice and what do they miss? How do they explain their choices and recommendations? How do they respond when you ask questions or disagree with a conclusion? Assignments like these should be short, requiring no more than a few hours of work. Respect your applicants. Your hiring process should not be a cover to obtain free consulting. If you'd prefer to use longer projects to evaluate a candidate, you can always hire them part-time as a consultant, then bring them on full-time if you're pleased with their work. This general hiring process is a straightforward, effective way to discover and evaluate promising employees and contractors. It's important to note that this process doesn't rely on resumes or traditional interviews, which only really test for how well the candidate writes a resume and performs in an interview. If you look for past performance and evaluate a candidate's work firsthand, you'll make much better hires. Chapter 9. Understanding systems. Businesses are complex systems that exist within even more complex systems, markets, industries, and societies. A complex system is a self-perpetuating arrangement of interconnected parts that form a unified whole. In this chapter, you'll learn common elements of all systems, how environmental factors influence the function of a system, and the ever-present nature of uncertainty and change. Gall's Law. Here's a weekend project for you. Build a car from scratch. No pre-manufactured parts or plans allowed. Just a block of metal, a few simple tools, your knowledge, and your imagination. How do you think the project will turn out? Even if the project takes a year, chances are it will be a complete disaster. If your car works at all, which is very, very unlikely, it'll be far less efficient and reliable than even the worst car from a commercial manufacturer. Now imagine building a modern computer, creating a cure for cancer, or cloning a human being from scratch without relying on anything someone else has already discovered. Inevitably, you'll suffer through a series of expensive and demoralizing failures. If you succeed, it'll take decades. Why is it so hard to build working complex systems from scratch? John Gall, one of the first major complex systems theorists, provided the answer. Here's Gall's law. All complex systems that work evolved from simpler systems that worked. Complex systems are full of variables and interdependencies that must be arranged just right in order to function. Complex systems designed from scratch will never work in the real world, since they haven't been subject to environmental selection forces while being designed. Uncertainty ensures that you will never be able to anticipate all of these interdependencies and variables in advance, so a complex system built from scratch will continually fail in all sorts of unexpected ways. Gall's law is where environmental selection tests, which we'll discuss in a moment, meet systems design. If you want to build a system that works, the best approach is to build a simple system that meets the environment's current selection tests first, then improve it over time. Over time, you'll build a complex system that works. Gall's law is why prototyping and iteration work so well as a value creation methodology. Instead of building a complex system from scratch, building a prototype is much easier. It's the simplest possible creation that will help you verify that your system meets critical selection tests. Expanding that prototype into a minimum viable offer allows you to validate your critical assumptions, resulting in the simplest possible system that can succeed with actual purchasers. Iteration and incremental augmentation, over time, will produce extremely complex systems that actually work, even as the environment changes. If you want to build a system that works from scratch, violate Gall's law at your peril. Flow. No matter what a system actually does, it will have flows, movements of resources into and out of the system. Imagine an automotive assembly line. Raw materials like steel, plastic, silicon, rubber, and glass flow in, and a finished car flows out. Inflows are resources moving into a system. Water into a sink, money into a bank account, raw materials into an assembly line, new hires into a company. Outflows are resources flowing out of a system. Water draining out from a sink, money flowing out of a bank account, finished goods exiting an assembly line, employees leaving the company due to retirement, termination, or changing jobs. Follow the flows, and you're on your way to understanding how the system works. Stock. Follow a system's flows, and you'll find places where resources tend to pool together. In this case, a stock isn't a certificate of business ownership. It's a pool or a holding tank of resources. A bank account is a good example of a stock. It's a pool of money waiting to be used. Inventories, queues of customers, and waiting lists are also examples of stocks. To increase a stock, increase inflows and/or decrease outflows. If you want to increase the size of your bank account, put more money in and take less money out. If you're building cars and you're consistently running out of engines, either slow down the line or add more engines to your inventory. To decrease a stock, decrease inflows and/or increase outflows. If you have too much inventory, stop producing units or increase sales. If waiting lists are too long, increase throughput or reduce the number of people entering the line. Find the system's stocks, and you'll discover pools of resources waiting to be used. Slack. Since stocks are pools of resources, it pays to understand how many resources you have to work with. Slack is the amount of resources present in a stock. The more resources you have in a stock, the more slack you have. For a system to operate efficiently, stocks should be just the right size, not too big and not too small. Think of our hypothetical automotive manufacturing system. It's a combination of many smaller systems, each of which is designed to create a stock of parts. If there's no stock of engines waiting to be installed when a car reaches that part of the assembly line, that's an issue, The car will have to wait until an engine is ready, which holds up everything in line behind it. To avoid this issue, it's best to ensure that the stock is big enough to handle the level of outflows that are required to keep the system running. Inflows replenish the stock as it's depleted. Large stocks have the most slack, but that flexibility comes at a cost. If you have 500 engines waiting around to be installed, you'll have a lot of funds tied up in inventory, which reduces your cash flow. You'll also have to pay for space to store the engines so they aren't lost or damaged, which increases your costs and decreases your profit margin. Small stocks are more efficient, but have less slack. If you only have a stock of 2 or 3 engines, you won't have a huge amount of resources tied up in inventory, but the probability of running out of engines is much higher if the assembly line speeds up or there's a problem with the engine manufacturing system. Slack is tricky to manage. Too much, and you're wasting time and money. Too little, and your system faces the risk of running out of the resources necessary to continue operating. Constraint. The performance of a system is always limited by the availability of a critical input. Alleviate the constraint, and the system's performance will improve. In the book, The Goal, A Process of Ongoing Improvement, Eliyahu Goldratt explains what he calls the theory of constraints. Any manageable system is always limited in achieving more of its goal by at least one constraint. If you can identify and alleviate the constraint, you'll increase the throughput of the system. Creating or increasing the size of a stock in front of a constraint can help alleviate the issue. If you're constantly running out of engines, increasing the slack in your engine stock is the best way to alleviate the constraint. By ensuring that the constraint isn't starved, you can increase the performance of the entire system. In order to find and alleviate a constraint, Goldratt proposes the 5 focusing steps, a method you can use to improve the throughput of any system. Number 1, identification, examining the system to find the limiting factor. If your automotive assembly line is constantly waiting on engines in order to proceed, engines are your constraint. Number 2, exploitation, ensuring that the resources related to the constraint aren't wasted. If the employees responsible for making engines are also building windshields, or stop building engines during lunchtime, exploiting the constraint would be having the engine employees spend 100% of their available time and energy producing engines and having them work in shifts so breaks can be taken without slowing down production. Number 3, subordination. Redesigning the entire system to support the constraint. Let's assume you've done everything you can to get the most out of the engine production system, but you're still behind. Subordination would be rearranging the factory so everything needed to build the engine is close at hand, instead of requiring certain materials to come from the other side of the factory. Other subsystems may have to move or lose resources, but that's not a huge deal since they're not the constraint. Number 4, elevation, permanently increasing the capacity of the constraint. In the case of the factory, elevation would be buying another engine-making machine and hiring more workers to operate it. Elevation is very effective, but it's expensive. You don't want to spend millions on more equipment if you don't have to. That's why exploitation and subordination come first. You can often alleviate a constraint quickly without resorting to spending more money. And number 5, re-evaluation. After making a change, re-evaluating the system to see where the constraint is located. Inertia is your enemy. Don't assume engines will always be the constraint. Once you make a few changes, the limiting factor might become windshields. In that case, it doesn't make sense to continue focusing on increasing engine production. The system won't improve until windshields become the focus of improvement. The 5 focusing steps are very similar to iteration velocity. The more quickly you move through this process and the more cycles you complete, the more your system's throughput will improve. Feedback loop. Cause and effect are easy enough to consider, but what happens when effects become causes themselves? Feedback loops exist whenever the output of a system becomes one of the inputs in the next cycle. Feedback is how systems learn. If the system is capable of perceiving its environment, that